Okay, you're tuned to WHPK 88.5 FM in Chicago. You are now listening to the Sitting in the Park show. Today I have a very special show with one of the heroes of the show. I'm very happy and very lucky to have him on the air. I have actually Kenny Burke, member of the Five Stair Steps and solo artist in his own right, who is going to be telling the story of his group, who is probably the most popular group on this show and one of the most important groups to come out of Chicago. So, first of all, Kenny, can you hear me?
I hear you loud and clear, Bob.
Okay, well, first of all, I got to say thanks again. I'm so happy to have you on the show. It's such an honor to have you tell your story on the show. So, first of all, I thought we could start talking about your group. What part of Chicago are you from?
We're originally from the south side of Chicago.
And did you all grow up in the same place, or did you move around? Like, what area are you from?
Well, we moved around quite a bit. We started out born and raised in the Dearborn Homes. That was on 29th and State way back in the day in the 50s. And then we moved from there into our first house on East 90th Street, and then moved to 91st Street about three blocks away, and then we moved to 87th Street in South Park, which is now King Drive, and then we moved down to 99th and King Drive, right across the street from the motor vehicle. So we always moved around quite a bit.
And how did your family and you, how did you and your family get involved with music?
Well, that's kind of a good question. We, believe it or not, were always exposed to a lot of great music. Our mom and dad were big fans of good music. I mean, we're going back from Dinah Washington to Nat King Cole to you name it. So we were always exposed to music as kids growing up. And our mother also, with my aunt, loved Latin music. So, believe it or not, we started out first singing Latin music without knowing the words, not understanding the language, but that's really what we ironically first started singing, Latin songs.
Well, what were some of the Latin, like Latin artists and Latin songs?
Well, of course, back in those days, Tito Puente, Tito Rodriguez, you know, those were the kings back in those days, and there were other artists, but, you know, you're talking about Kenny Burke back then was all a mere 3, 4, 5 years old. So, you know, it was so much music, though, going on that we were always listening to music. And as closely as we are in age, you can see how it would be very easy for us all to just gel and come together, singing parts together. And then, you know, my oldest brother, Clarence, you know, we just always kind of, we were best friends. We were very close. So anything one did, all did. So that's how it all kind of began.
So was there a year that you officially formed a group? Because like in a lot of the stories, they say the Stair Steps formed in 58. Is that the year the group formed?
Well, you know, formed in the aspect of when we probably started to perform talent shows or little local functions, being known as the Five Stair Steps, which was a name that our mother gave us because we were all in chronological order, and she said when she'd look at us sitting down on the couch, we look like stair steps. So that's how the name came about, and then it just all kind of just developed. But 58, by no means were we professional at that time.
And how, and were you the youngest member in 58 of the group?
Correct. And my sister Aloha was the oldest, my brother Clarence, second, James, third, Dennis, fourth, and I was fifth. And of course, going back in the 50s, our youngest baby brother QB, he wasn't on the scene at that time, so it was just the five of us, right?
So, and how old were you when you started singing with the group in 58?
Oh, my God, I would have been 5 years old.
Okay.
Now, that was a trick, Bob, question there, Bob. Now you're making me tell my age.
Okay.
It's all good, man. Listen, hey, I'm proud of it. Yeah, 58, 5 years old, And you just do the math on up from there, with me being the youngest, everybody up to my sister probably was 10 years old at that time.
I mean, you should be proud to have started singing like the way that you did that early in your life.
Absolutely, absolutely. I mean, just think of what we were exposed to and the benefit that we had, opportunities, being able to come up in a time where music was, you know, so rich in everything that we know now. No question, those artists back in those days, the greats, you know, are irreplaceable. You know, you'll never ever have that kind of talent again. So we were very blessed, and we knew that we were very fortunate to have come up in such an enriched time with music being just so real. So, oh, no question about it.
So one question that is like an important question for me is the five stair steps were so important in sort of like listening to your records that you put out in the mid-60s. They kind of defined the Chicago sound, and you guys had your own harmony. And I'm wondering sort of how you came up with that sound, because you were like a kiddie group, but you weren't doing bubblegum, like you weren't like Frankie Lyman the Teenagers. You had a very adult sound, and you defined the Chicago sound, but you also didn't sound like other Chicago groups at the time. So I'm wondering how you came up with that harmony and that sound.
Well, that's a good point. I'll tell you, it's a combination of probably the two most important factors for that. Was one, we only listened to the real serious adult songs. We did not listen to, I mean, and what was really out there other than Frankie Lyman and the Teenagers, you know, that was really bubblegum. So we really listened to all of the adult acts, and being that we were so close with our age and our timber vocally, it kind of was almost like what we do now in the studio when we stack our voices. You know, you can sing your record once and then what we call overdub multiple times. So imagine that same concept, but live you had five singers that very much had the same characteristic vocally. So I think that's what gave us our unique sound. And the vibrato also added to that, which oftentimes would give off harmonics that would give the illusion of notes that were there that weren't. So it was all of those little things, I think, that came together for us that gave us our uniqueness.
Yeah, you're saying kind of it just happened that way because you all were sort of family and your voices just gelled in a specific way.
Absolutely, and being very real about it, let's face it, you know, all of the genius that everyone wants to take credit for, a lot of times, Bob, it's just stuff that happened, and I'm not going to make it any more. You know, hey, look, you know, some, and then the good news is this. It's our fans and people that recognized it that said, wow, that's a great sound, because, you know, maybe people don't like what you sound like. So fortunately for us, what we did have was something that people loved and felt was special, because that's the bottom line, right?
Yeah, and another thing is there another thing that made your sound different was the way that it was more mature, because like Chicago sound, a lot of the time it was also kind of like a teen kind of sound. Like there were groups like Henry Ford and the Gifts, and they sounded like kiddie groups, even though they had nice harmony. But your sound was very adult sounding, and I think you can hear also some of the Latin influences that you had been talking about too.
Well, sure, and you know, when you're going back in the time with Little Anthony and the Imperials, and you know, the Sam Cooke, the Impressions, and even maybe Smokey and the Miracles weren't really out so much in the 50s, but those, you know, like when Jerry Butler and Curtis Mayfield and the Impressions were, of course, the kings of Chicago, before there was really even Motown being strong as they eventually came up to be, we were always fascinated by harmony, and of course Chicago being doo-wop's capital of the world, you know, we put in our stock and trade also, and we took it very serious. And one other thing, which would kind of maybe be going a little further up into years down the road, but we were very particular about what we would do and what we would not thing. We never saw ourselves as being that kiddie kind of sound, and we never really gravitated towards that. We always loved just whatever any and the other thing was, our songs were not really written for young people. The song was written, we were able to sing it and make it believable and convincing, but none of the songs that were written for us were ever written for us as a quote unquote child group.
And you could kind of see it in the look of your 60s photos too. Like, you were always clean with the suits. You didn't have like crazy performance outfits or anything like that.
Yeah, and you know, and we talked about this earlier in the week, Bob, and I want to go on and go right to this now. We had a almost like a sixth member who wasn't part of the group, but there was a guy by the name of Gregory Fowler. Gregory Fowler wrote "You Waited Too Long," "World of Fantasy," "Come Back," all of those great songs that were on our first album. And he was probably 3 or 4 years even older than my oldest brother and sister. So he was like an older brother, an older person that was teaching us these songs and teaching us and really getting the discipline instilled in us with the harmony and whatnot and how to sing. So, you know, we had, once again, already the preparation of more maturity because we had someone who was, in fact, much older than us that wasn't treating us like we were kids. And, you know, no one related to us like, well, these are kids, so you got to down, you know, knock it down a few notches so that they can pull it off. It was never the case. And my brother Clarence's vocal style, you know, was totally original. He didn't try to sing like anyone else. He didn't sound like anyone else. And that combined with the harmonies that we had, and also, you know, you can tell that these are young people singing. Obviously, we didn't sound like grown men and women, but it just had a flavor of, wow, well, this isn't like kiddie stuff, but you knew it was young people, which made it, I think, even go over even better, because it's like, wow, listen to these young kids blowing some serious harmony, singing some serious love songs. So, you know, we just were unknowingly at the time being prepared for everything that was inevitably there for us to inherit and become. So, you know, it's a lot of things that you could spin it, a lot of ways you could spin it, but, you know, we were just fortunate that it all just worked out that way.
And how did you meet Gregory Fowler?
Greg was, now, I will always first say to everybody listening that I was the youngest member. So a lot of things that were going on, I'm not going to tell you I knew everything and every incident in time, but I do know that we came to know Gregory probably, I would say, around 1962 or 1963 when we lived over on East 90th Street, and he became acquainted with us because we were kind of popular in the neighborhood and community, doing talent shows and doing little community benefits and whatnot. And once he got to know us and knew that we were serious about singing, it was like just on. It was like, well, come on, you guys, let me teach you this song. And we would sing some of the standards, and we'd learn stuff. And then those great songs like "You Waited Too Long" and "World of Fantasy" and "Come Back" started to develop, and we would sing and learn. And it was just the molding was starting then. So by the time we got up to, say, 64, we pretty much had what was the substance of what became the five stair steps that everyone knows now was pretty much already there.
So you said you had started to do talent shows around town in, like, 58. Were they, like, at elementary schools? Like, what types of shows were they? And
Well, talent shows. And I recall that we would just do sometimes functions like, you know, back in those days, you had like bazaars, you had like little community events, you know. And if there was someone, I guess, that my parents knew and they wanted some entertainment, it would be a perfect opportunity to showcase our talent. So more so, it wasn't so much that we were just participating in a lot of talent shows. As a matter of fact, those were far and few between. It was more these little functions that would just happen throughout. Maybe you would sing it like a church function, okay, or something like that. So we did have a following where when we would perform, we went over well, and we started to kind of get a sense that we did have something special. But we weren't like out there just talent show, trying to win to get to a point where we could be, could get known anymore. Enough. It was just all fun for us.
You're saying it was more like a friends and family type neighborhood?
Sure.
Thing.
Yeah.
So,
exactly.
So what types of material were you doing before Gregory started to help you?
Well, I know that we loved Ray Charles. So I do remember singing Ray Charles, you know, Tell the Truth with Margie Hendrix and whatnot. We would sing, I know we sang What's Your Name? I think that was Don and Juan.
Yeah.
And then as time went on, I remember Stubborn Kind of Fella was one of the songs we would sing. And then, you know, then we got later on with the Ooh Baby Baby and stuff like that. But, no, we sang a lot of... And it wasn't so much that we did had a vast repertoire, a wide repertoire, or any of that. It was just whatever we did go after, we really practiced and we tried to get as good at it as we could. But I know Ray Charles was a big crowd pleaser for us when we would do those songs. It really was fun, and that went over well because I would sing the Margie Hendrix parts on To Tell the Truth, and Clarence would do, you know, the Ray Charles thing, and he had Ray Charles down pretty well for a kid probably about 10 or 11 years old. So, it, you know, having kids doing, it was a stretch to tackle those kind of performers, and when you got kids that kind of come off sounding, hey, man, these guys are really serious about what they're doing and taking it serious, it just went over well. It was just fascinating and great.
Yeah, it's funny that you were a Raylette.
Yeah, exactly.
So what year did your older brother and sister enter high school?
Okay, I got to do the math. So I would say, 5 years back, 65, 12, probably 63. My sister and brother would have probably started high school in 60 or 63.
And what high school did they go to?
Harlan.
And were there other groups at the school at the time, or were you like the main group there?
Well, we were not even at you know, professional status at that time. But I remember there was a lot of talent. You know, Chicago, when it comes to singing, you know, everyone knows that we had, you know, some of the best talent coming out of Chicago. To name maybe a few groups, I do remember the Rotations. Beyond that, I can't say too many more, but it wasn't a lot of camaraderie back then, you got to remember too, because most people that we were performing around or with were always much older than us.
And
so we were so young that most of the times we would just come in and do our thing, and then we'd keep going, and wasn't always aware of everything maybe that was playing into it around us. But we did do something at Harlan years ago. I remember doing a performance there, and it was just one time. Okay, and I don't recall, it wasn't like a camaraderie, I think, of us knowing and coming up with a lot of other musicians or singers in Chicago, because once again, we were more family oriented, and whatever we did was really just the fun of it. We weren't really out there trying to compete and trying to get in to be known and perform. When we would, it was just basically a matter of the circumstance at the time that just lent itself to it. So our whole history within the framework of coming up wasn't really so much apparent at that time.
Yeah, and that probably, like you were saying before, accounts for your unique sound, because the other Chicago groups were all hanging out with each other and learning from each other, and you were just learning from your family at the time.
That, that, You know what? There it is. I mean, you said that very well. I mean, from us being more isolated and just feeding off of ourselves, we did not have those external influences, absolutely.
So you ultimately, in your story, there's a famous talent show that you did at the Regal Theater. When could you talk about that? When did that happen?
The Regal Theater, well, that now is the pivotal point where we started to really take it more serious and become a little more competitive. And the Regal Talent Show had to have been in latter part of 63 or 64. And that talent show, I believe, went for about 2 or 3 days. It was one of the largest talent shows that I can recall ever being in Chicago for new talent. And, that was where we won and beat out a lot of folks. And I want to say I believe the Jacksons were a part of that talent show back in those days, the Jackson 5. And we were fortunate to have won the whole talent show. And then we still didn't move into becoming professional or get a record deal even from that, because that wasn't really necessarily our goal. We just went from straight competitiveness and feeling that we were good enough to win, and our parents wanted to, get us on in to compete. So that was just the first step, I guess, that you could say, where we really started to take ourselves seriously.
So previously you were just kind of doing it for fun.
Absolutely.
And you're saying you entered the talent show because your parents encouraged you to enter it?
Yes. I mean, I think that at that time it became we were getting a little older, and I think that from the response that we would get from the times we would do performances around town, that our parents, who were so supportive to us and just allowed us to, I mean, when I think back, we used to, where we didn't have bongos or instruments, we used to beat on pots and pans. And I just recently said to my mom and dad, I said, you know what? You guys really, really were really great, because I'm a parent now. I'm like, could I see 5 kids beating on pots and pans? I don't think so. but you know what they said to me? They said, well, it wasn't like it was noise to us, because you guys were making sense with it. So we were like, hey, check it out. Look what they're doing. They're making, it wasn't noise, in other words. It was musical. So when you take that kind of support from all the way up until this now Regal theater talent competition comes up, we always had their full 1,000% support, and they really believed that we had what it took. And Gregory Fowler was in our lives at that time also, where we were now really more disciplined with it, where it wasn't no longer just fun. It was now, okay, we're trying to really make a statement and make a point. So, yeah, things then became, okay, if we were going to have an opportunity to do something professionally, I think that started to maybe make people start to give it more of a real serious thought.
Do you remember what you sang at the talent show?
Oh, of course. Ooh, baby, baby.
Okay. Did that become one of your signature songs?
Well, that was on our first album, because that song, of course, being also one of our favorite groups, The Miracles, Smokey and the Miracles, that was on the first album. My brother James sang Ooh, Baby, Baby, but it was my brother Clarence who sang the lead at the Regal Talent Show. And I'm going to tell you right now, we killed him with that song. It was just phenomenal. The response that we got, it was just, I can't say that we ever had a better crowd in our professional career than that day or those days that performed at the Regal Theater. I'll never forget it.
Yeah, that sounds awesome.
Yeah, it was awesome.
So one question about the thing is, I think in the stories about your group, supposedly the prize of the talent show was a record contract. So is it true that the prize of the talent show was a record contract? And if what label was supposed to get the contract? And you didn't get a contract from the talent show, did you?
Well, now, my memory serving me as best as I can recall was there was a record contract, but nothing came from it.
Okay.
Nothing really came about either nothing came about from it or my parents decided not to choose that avenue. But we did not immediately go into a contract or, like, say, an American Idol kind of thing where, okay, now you win and you swept off and you go into the studio and now start them. No. There was a substantial amount of time after the Regal Theater before we had our opportunity to actually be signed.
So what's the story? How did you end up getting signed?
Well, my dad met Fred Cash of the Impressions. Fred Cash and Sam Gooden moved a couple of houses down on the same block where we lived on 87th off of South Park at the time. And my dad, being, you know, a Chicago policeman for many years, he came across Mr. Cash and asked him if he would come by to hear the group. And this didn't, once again, happen immediately. This was something that I think my dad was working on or may have put out there, and maybe even himself may not have known if it would actually happen, because you can imagine how hot the Impressions were back in the 60s. So with their busy schedules, I'm sure that maybe they meant well, but maybe just couldn't get by at the same time. And they did not see the talent show, so it was basically whatever blind faith or salesmanship that my father had done to persuade him to come by. But now we're talking about living on 99th and King Drive, which was after we moved away from 87th, and Fred Cash came by. We were just completely blown away. Here's one of the Impressions who was in Chicago, I would say even over the Miracles or any Motown act, the Impressions were our all-time favorite.
Yeah.
So when we had Fred Cash come by the house, it was just, you know, I mean, come on. It was just unbelievable, blowing. So he sat us down and said, okay, let me hear a song. First song we sang for him was World of Fantasy. He listened to 16 bars. That means intro, first verse, hook. He stopped us, said, okay, just stop. Next thing you know, he said, I need a minute. Can I use the telephone? We didn't know what to think. He makes a phone call, and next thing you know, he's telling us, I need you guys to get yourselves together. Can you come on over to Curtis Mayfield's to hear you? So what? Curtis Mayfield. So that same night, with that same encounter, from Fred hearing just 16 bars of World of Fantasy was enough for him to say, I think that these guys are serious enough for me to now take them to my guy, who, you know, Curtis was the leader of the Impressions, the writer and producer for everything they did. And we went over to Mr. Mayfield's house that night. He heard us, and the rest was history. We were in the studio probably, I don't think, more than 3 or 4 weeks after that encounter.
Do you remember what year and around what month that was?
I knew it was the fall of 65.
Okay.
Fall of 65. Mm-hmm.
So the records ended up being released on a record label called Windy Sea, which I guess was Curtis's label distributed by Cameo Parkway.
Correct.
Did he form the label just to put you guys out?
If memory serves me right, we were the first act on Windy Sea, and Windy Sea didn't exist before that, so I guess you could draw to that inclusion that, sure, that's probably the case.
And your very first record was a hit, right?
You Waited Too Long, Don't Waste Your Time was a two-sided hit in Chicago. It was what back then in those days, VON would do what they would call, they would flip the record. So you play the A and B side. And you don't waste your time was number one, and you waited too long was number one.
And it was one of those rare things where pretty much every side of every single they released on you was a classic. Like, it just kind of defined the Chicago sound at the time.
Yeah, it was just like, you know, oftentimes first albums are sometimes always the defining moment of an artist's career. And for us, it was certainly true. That album was like our greatest hits album because every song on that album was what's the most memorable, with the exception of maybe one or two that we ever recorded.
Yeah, and I mean, even some of the B-sides that didn't make the album, like You Can't See, like some of the, like every song is amazing that they put out on you. Like, it was just kind of amazing, the quality of the material. And you guys actually wrote a lot of the songs, didn't you?
Well, you know, contrary to popular belief, in the very beginning, most of the songs were written by Gregory Fowler and of course those that I cited earlier with He Waited Too Long, World of Fantasy, and Come Back, were Greg Fowler songs. And then of course Curtis Mayfield, wrote a lot of songs for us also in the beginning. Then down the road, by the time we did our second album, is when my oldest brother Clarence Jr. started really doing more of the, material. And from that point, as we developed down the road, we all became eventually songwriters on our own. But in the stair step years, as those early years go, it was Curtis, Greg Fowler, and my brother Clarence Jr. that was writing. Well, Clarence wrote one of our greatest, I mean, all-time favorites, Danger, She's a Stranger, when he was just 16 years old.
Yeah, definitely. That's one of the greatest Chicago soul records ever, pretty much.
Yes. And, yes, indeed.
And you had talked about before getting signed, you were just kind of doing it for fun, and all of a sudden you had these big hits out. Did you sort of start to change your attitude, and did you start to tour nationally? Like, what was happening at the time?
Well, you know, for when you're the great thing about being young is that you don't take yourself too serious. So for us, it was always fun, and it was always an adventure. And then our first show was at the Regal Theater with Smokey Robinson and the Miracles. And that was just, you know, from that point on, you know, an unbelievable first-time encounter, because here you are being produced and recorded by your all-time Chicago favorite group, The Impressions, and then you end up performing your first major show with your all-time Motown favorite artist, The Miracles. So, you know, for us, it was just a fantastic, unbelievable ride. It was just heaven on earth.
Did you have to develop choreography too at that point?
Well, you know, we were no different than most Chicago doo-wop acts. We were finger poppers, stand around the mic and concentrate on blowing that harmony. That was your first objective. You know, a Chicago act, you got to be on point with your harmony. So in our first year, that's all we did, is just pop our fingers and get around that mic and blow. And as we started to learn and be exposed to more professionals and being around acts like The Miracles, I even remember the Artistics and other groups that we were performing with, then we realized, we need to probably incorporate a little bit more excitement into our show. And that's when choreography became like mandatory. And we didn't have the luxury of having a professional choreographer or any of that stuff. Everything we did was homegrown. In other words, right out of the same group. And our older brother Clarence, once again, he stepped up to the plate and taught us every choreography step that we ever did. It all came from Clarence Jr.
Did you have any signature moves?
Yeah, they were all signature moves because they were all so unorthodox. You know, when you now you got to imagine this, Bob. You know, brother, and as with all of us, none of us were like dance guys. You know, we weren't into like really dancing. We were kind of shy, even at parties. You know, if a new dance came out, we weren't like the first ones to know the dance and be, you know, out there on the dance floor. We were kind of, you know, more laid back. So here's a guy that wasn't known by any means as a dancer. So anything that came out of his head to teach us, it's just uncanny and ingenious that someone with no dance training whatsoever and did not study, or he wasn't like, you know, under someone's tutelage that he's like learning anything. It just was all off the top of his head. And then each one of us, my brother, Dennis, James, and myself, and my sister, gave it our own little, you know, flavor, and then made it, because Clarence, we talk about this all the time, and he jokes, he says, man, yeah, I might have been the lead singer and the one out front singing the lead, but he said, I would look at you guys out of the corner of my eye and see you guys busting those steps. And I would say, what am I doing over here singing the lead? I want to be over here doing the steps with these guys. They look like they're having so much fun. So it was just, once again, one of those things where I guess you could say just being totally original and not having any mold, so to say, that we fit in or follow, it just made everything just work uniquely.
And did you tour nationally at that point?
Yes, yes. Well, at that point in time, back in the 60s, late 60s, you know, you would tour everywhere from New York through Pennsylvania, all the theater dates, Chicago, D.C., Apollo, New York. There was the Uptown Theater in Philadelphia, the Howard Theater in D.C., Regal Theater. And rarely, and then you would do these massive tours where then you'd have the Impressions, Jackie Wilson, Otis Redding, and Betty Wright, Betty Swan. Everybody would just go out on these big tours, and then that's where you would get your Southern exposure, and you would get on the tour bus and do all the Southern states. Rarely would you go out west, because Los Angeles was a very expensive trip to make just to go do one city. So most of the acts in those days would tour Midwest and then go across country to the east, New York, and then come down and do the South. And that was basically the circuit in those days.
And I've seen a clip of you. It's a pretty awesome TV clip on YouTube of you're performing. I think it's a TV show in Pittsburgh, maybe, and you're performing at like a pier. I think you might be doing World of Fantasy.
That was our very first TV show, if memory, if not the first, because I know To Tell the Truth. Do you remember that show called To Tell the Truth?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a TV-like game show where they had to guess the identity. If that wasn't our first, To Tell the Truth might have been, but it was certainly one of the first TV things we ever did.
And what show was that in Pittsburgh?
I believe that was Where the Action Is.
Okay. So you were actually – who was on To Tell the Truth?
Well, To Tell the Truth was the way that was set up was –
yeah, you have to guess the person. You have to guess the person, right?
You got to guess the identity, and our father came on as the contestant, where he was the Chicago policeman that had five children that were a singing group. Of course, at that time, we were unknown, so the panel had to guess – who was, in fact, Clarence Burke. So, all right, some maybe have guessed, some maybe didn't, but my father would then stand up and give his true identity, and then they segued into, and here are the five steps up, here's his children, and we performed Danger, She's a Stranger.
That's awesome. I hope that clip still exists somewhere. Someone has to find that.
Yeah, yes, it will. And now, thinking about that, it would have been that show that you were referring to that was in Pittsburgh of us at the pier, that would have been our first show, because that was World of Fantasy, and World of Fantasy was recorded way before Danger. So that was the first one.
And when you were touring at that point, were you out of school? Like, were you being homeschooled at that point?
Yeah, by that point in time, we had to be tutored, simply because I recall that, you know, it got to the point where it started out being fun, you know, having that little popularity, but then it got to the point where we could not go to school because, you know, the girls were, like, chasing us home.
Okay. And one last question about your first record. I don't know if you remember this, but do you remember where the park was that you guys are sitting on the album cover?
I sure do. As a matter of fact, I made it my business to find that information out for you. It was at Washington Park on Cottage Grove and 60th Street.
No, that's right here where the radio station is.
See? I promised you, Bob, that I'd have that for you. And as soon as I asked my dad, he said, yeah, that was Washington Park on 60th and Cottage near Garfield or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Is the brick wall still there?
I don't know. I'm going to go looking for it now, though.
just make sure you go during the daytime.
So the first album got released on Windy Sea, and you released 7 singles on the label, and then you ended up moving to Buddha Records. Can you talk about what happened with that?
Yeah, well, you know, there was a little fluctuation, and for the sake of time, I'll just kind of let you know. Starting out with Windy City, then we went on a different direction where my oldest brother Clarence produced all of our second album, which was Buddha. And then after Buddha, which was still, by the way, the same people behind us, because it was a Neil Bogart who passed away, unfortunately, who did all of the Donna Summer, Casablanca stuff, the Village People. That's Neil Bogart, who was responsible for all of that stuff. So Neil and Cecil Holmes were, in fact, behind the Windy City Cameo Parkway label, and they were still there with the Buddha stuff. So it was always the same family, really, just different label names. And then from Buddha, we went back with Curtis Mayfield on our third album and did an album with him under his Kurtom label. So, and then back to Buddha.
So was the move to Buddha initially the idea that you guys wanted to try producing yourselves?
Well, you know, what simply the dynamic that was only changed was when Curtis wasn't producing us, then that meant that we just were on the mother label, because Buddha was distributing all of the labels at that time, even Kurtom. So once again, the only thing that just changed is if Curtis wasn't producing us, then we just appeared on what you would call the mother label, because Kurtom, Windy City was just subsidiaries of that label. But it was always the same family of record execs behind us, which was Neil Bogart and Cecil Holmes.
Okay, but you had said that on the second album, Clarence had written a lot more of the material.
Clarence, and this is something that I want to one day really, really highlight. He probably may have been one of the youngest people in the history of the record business to have the full reign of producing an entire album. Not only did he write, but he produced the entire second album that we did.
Which is amazing at such a young age.
Unbelievable. I mean, just to have the confidence and be able to take on that. And, you know, in those days, you know, we were recording with full 30-piece, 40-piece orchestras. And here's a kid, 16 years old, that has the weight of and responsibility on his shoulders. Come on, I don't know of anyone in the history of modern rock and roll and R&B music that ever had that honor ever bestowed upon them, that young, having an entire, and I don't mean he had anyone over his shoulder, like, you know, A&R folks will come in and critique and, you know, and make sure you're doing everything the way they want it to go. No, it was none of that. He was literally given full reign and confidence to do that record. Very awesome. Very awesome.
Yeah, and he managed to get, I think the biggest hit off that album was Something's Missing, which is a great song. But one thing I got to ask is, what's the story behind New Dance Craze?
New Death Tray. Okay. Well, that was kind of one of those things that just happened. Our baby brother QB, who was probably no more than probably a year and a half, a little over a year old at that time, barely even talking. You know, as we traveled as a family, QB was there and looking at his older, you know, brothers and sister, and he was, you know, getting very much into what we would do and emulate things. And we were out in the studio all talking, and someone had the tape running and rolling, as memory serves correct. And it became a thing where, wow, this would be a great kind of way to introduce QB, because my dad came from, I believe, his vision. I don't know if you remember, like, the Osmonds and Andy Williams had a special that actually introduced the Osmond brothers way before they became the Osmonds that the world knew, singing the One Bad Apple Don't Spoil the Whole Bunch Girl thing. But they were part of the Andy Williams show, and then there was a family called the King family, which was like back in the old 50s, like a variety show, right? So my dad, coming from that era, I believe he understood that, well, you know, we're a family, and everyone is talented, and hey, why not introduce new members and bring up new family members as they show their talent worthiness and introduce them? So QB came in as the Fire Stress and QB because he was the baby. We'd bring him out on the finale of the show. It was a thing we would do at the end of the show where QB would come out and do a little thing. My mom would come out. She would be introduced. And, of course, our father was probably on stage with us playing the bass guitar. So it was a whole family affair. And QB being the baby, it was more of a, I guess you could say, he was just as cute as a button. And whenever he'd come out on stage, people just loved him. So the Five Stair Steps and QB, more than it being a functioning, working concept, it just became, I think, something that just stuck with us because my dad saw that as being a way that he wanted us to develop eventually and become. But no, the New Dance Craze thing, it was just a thing that happened from somebody keeping a button on the recording, and there you go with QB singing every other word, mimicking the song as he would do at home. And it was just so cute that it was like, hey, this needs to be recorded and put it in.
Yeah.
That's how that happened. Yeah.
So then you got back with Curtis Mayfield for a second and started recording on Kurt Tom Records again, which was still a division of Buddha. Do you remember how you got back with Curtis?
Well, you know, I will say this, that, you know, you're always, as an artist, looking for as much opportunities that you can get for creative control. And once we were afforded that, I think that it became also apparent that we needed that that solid, experienced production and writing for us. So we did go back with Curtis to do the third album. And I believe that's the album with Who Baby Make Me Feel So Good on it.
Yeah, which is also one of your great – all the records, all the songs on that album are great too, but that's my favorite song off that album.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So that's great.
So you stayed with Kurt Tom for a couple more years, and you had a few more hits on Kurt Tom before your big breakout hit where you left Kurt Tom again to go back with Buddha. So what's the story with that?
Well, you know, we had some, you know, after you're on the road for 3-4 years, as we were, you know, we never really found that big crossover record. And back in those days, you know, every group looked forward to crossing over. And we wanted that to happen, and we had some opportunities that were there for us and different options. One, of course, was going with Motown that we opt out not to do. My father and brother met with Smokey Robinson, and they had a nice long talk, And at the end of that conversation, my dad, from that information he got from Smokey as what to expect with Motown, decided that we would give it a shot and go for ourselves and go back with Buddha and stay with Buddha, which we had never left, but we could have gone in a different direction. Our contract would have allowed us to at that time. But we decided to go on and stick it out with Buddha, and once again, still seeking that creative control. But we came across a young man, this was completely, probably the last thing you would think of doing, putting an R&B group with a young white writer and producer, a guy by the name of Stan Vincent. And that's when we did the album with U Child on it.
Okay, so it was explicitly, you're saying it was explicitly your goal to, like, you were shopping around for somewhere where you could get a crossover hit, and you ended up with Stan Vincent at Buddha for that.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, and did you know U Child was going to be a hit? Like, did he put it out and did it hit right away?
No, a matter of fact, U Child was a B-side, everyone.
Okay.
It was not the hit. And it was like not, it wasn't even to the point, you know, it's great when 40 years go by and you could tell the absolute truth, right, Bob? Okay. The A-side was a song, a Lennon and McCartney song by the Beatles called Dear Prudence. Okay? That song was not received very well by our R&B fans that knew stair-step, you know, vintage songs. And there was a couple of DJs in Philadelphia named Butterball and Jimmy Bishop, who were the program directors and the like the E. Rodney Jones and Herb Kent of Chicago. That's what they meant to Philadelphia at the time. And they flipped the record, and then U Child became a hit. And it just, like wildfire, just grew and grew and grew. But ironically, it really was more successful on pop radio than it was on R&B radio. And here's a true story. WLS and WCFL were the pop stations in Chicago, if you recall, went on the record before VON even played it. True story.
Okay, that's cool. Just because it was more of a pop song. It's interesting to hear that you're saying that DJs in Philly are the one that actually broke the record too.
That's right.
And they actually released an album on you, and it's the first album where they just called you the Stair Steps. They dropped the five from the name.
We just dropped the fives because at the time that our sister preferred to not do the road, but still do the album recording. She preferred to do recordings and not do the live work so much. So for the sake of just promoters and not worrying about the five and only four stair steps being there, we dropped the five. That was the only reason for that.
So did you start to do different types of shows at that time? Like you said, you were trying to cross over and you finally had a huge crossover hit. So did you start to do shows for different types of audiences at that time?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, with a huge, you know, I think U Child was number two on the pop charts. You know, when you got a big pop record like that, where Close to You by the Carpenters, Make It With You, and U Child, those were the top three songs in the country at the time. So anytime you have that kind of success, you're going to cross over and you're going to do more, play for more pop audiences as well. But, you know, we never stopped doing playing for our roots. But, yeah, we definitely were at that time now becoming more exposed to a pop audience and pop scene.
What were some of the big pop venues that you played or pop TV shows?
Well, you know, when it comes to TV, the easiest thing to say back in those days were that you had a lot of music specials. Kraft had a lot of music specials, but this is the irony of it. Politics were so strong then. The only two major shows that we did not perform at was Ed Sullivan Show and the Dick Clark Show. And I'll put that out when I write my book, but there's reasons for that. But everything basically else that was out, we did all of the other major shows that was out there.
Okay. And one thing that's interesting is by your next album, which was your last Buddha album, it seems like you even tried to cross over more, even with your style. Like looking at the photos, you're dressed all psychedelic, like Beatles and Sly Stone, and there's even a Sly Stone cover on the record. So were you starting to actually get into that sort of more rock music personally?
Well, yeah, and you know, I mean, and this is something that I've always been wanting to put straight for the record, with any fans that Sue back in the years questioned that direction that we were going in, and some may have felt like we abandoned the roots that we started with. But you've got to keep in mind that in the late 60s, early 70s, there was an entirely different culture that was taking over. And just like we've experienced with hip-hop now coming in, you know, rock and the whole hippie thing was big with Jimi Hendrix and Sly and the Family Stone, and, you know, those acts were now starting to become the music of choice that people were looking at alternatives to just the same R&B as we knew it with Motown and so forth and so on. And we were always leaning more towards doing new, different stuff, and we started playing more and becoming more in tune to our musicianship. So it was almost like we didn't really abandon what we started, but we were growing and getting older. You know, we weren't just youngsters anymore. We were coming into our young adulthood. So there's no question that we started to really want to explore different music, which was what was happening at the time.
You're saying you were progressive with your style and your, I mean, that you weren't, because you weren't going to do the same thing for 20 years. Like,
no, and our character and makeup, that doesn't usually work too well with us anyway. We got to keep it moving.
And one thing I didn't ask you about is, when did you start learning to play an instrument? Because previously we had just talked about you singing.
Right. Well, yes, and see, that's a very good question, because see, we were fascinated as much with being musicians as we were with being vocal artists or the choreography, any of the other stuff. And I was 12 years old when I first started playing my instrument, which was the bass. And my brother Clarence had already been playing the guitar. So if we're talking, I'm 12, he's 16, where I was doing recording sessions, not just for my family, which on the album that my brother Clarence produced, that second album, I played the bass on all of the album. So I was just 12 years old. And Curtis would even come by, Curtis Mayfield, he would just drop by the house and say, "Hey, baby, where's your bass? Come on, cat, let's go. We'll take you to the studio." And we would go, he'd just snatch me up, and my mom would say, "Okay, he's down there in the basement." And Curtis would take me, next thing you know, I'm in the studio with him and playing. I've done sessions with Donnie Hathaway, the Impressions. It wasn't just Stair Steps. And then, you know, my brother Clarence and I were the youngest and the oldest boys, but he and I were like, just like glue together. Anything that really was going on in the family creatively, he and I were just really very, very much into our musicianship, and it almost became overwhelming where that started to set the tone for what we wanted to do, because, you know, as a musician, there's no boundaries. When you're an artist, you kind of got to stick to a certain format because that's what people expect of you. And we were just very, the perfect word is progressive with it. That's it.
So that I guess leads up to, let me say, it was very interesting to hear that you actually played session work on probably other Kurt Tom records. I never knew about that. But then we also were talking about how your last record came out, I think it's 72 on Buddha, And then there was a 3-year gap before you started recording again for the Dark Horse label as the Stair Steps when you released your second Resurrection album. So were you active in music for that 3-year period?
Well, you know, there was a time where, personally, I retired from the record business by choice because I started to seek more spiritual development,
okay,
you could say, as well as, you know, we started to marry, and my brother Clarence had married, Dennis had married, and then when I finally did marry, this is now where you're talking about coming into adulthood, and there was 3 years where I personally left the industry, and my brothers still performed and still worked. And I had just made a decision that it was necessary for me to become my own person, I guess you could say, which you could probably understand when you look at other groups that we've become to see how time has passed on, and you can see how the record business, as great as it is and all the wonderful things that it has in the way of fame and fortune. But sometimes you can see some things are wanting in those who have not had an opportunity to just live a regular, normal life. And I sought that for myself and saw that that was something that I needed and wanted. And I took the time to do that, and I would never trade that for anything in the world, because it was those few years that really gave me the foundation to become the person that I am today.
So you're saying during those 3 years, your brothers kept performing as the Stair Steps?
That's right. That's right.
And what you're saying makes a lot of sense, because when you finally did come out with new material, it was very progressive, and you had totally changed up your style again. So could you talk about the album, the second Resurrection album, how it came about?
Well, the second Resurrection album was basically works that each one of my brothers and I had already started to accumulate from our own personal writings. Even though we weren't performing together, we all were still in tune with one another's material and knew what was going on with each other. Clarence had songs, and now we're talking about him, of course, being the forerunner as far as already being up and running with recordings he had done much, much sooner than we did. So now all the rest of the brothers are coming into their own now and starting to write and show promise. Well, I had three or four songs that I had recorded at Kurtom, where Curtis let me use the studio for 2 or 3 days, and I recorded these four songs, of which are on the second Resurrection album. And George Harrison was a good friend of Billy Preston's at the time. I was playing on the road with Billy, touring as a bassist, because I did, after maybe 2 or 3 years of not being in the industry, did decide to get back just wanting to play as a musician. So I toured a lot with Billy Preston, and, you know, was very close with Larry Graham and hung out with Sly and Larry and Billy through a lot of those early years in my early 20s. So when I met George Harrison over Billy Preston's house, I played George these four songs that I had recorded at Kurtom. From Us to You, Tell Me Why, with a couple others on there. And Billy, being such a advocate and good friend of the family, said, "Kenny, this would be, you know, a great time to call your brothers and see if everybody wants to get back together." So we did that, and then all of us came back together to do the Dark Horse Second Resurrection album. That's how that all came about. So that was probably a time where each member had come into their own as songwriters.
So the From Us to You, the version that's on the album, is not what you recorded on at Kurtom. You redid it for the album, right?
Correct. Exactly.
And sorry, I cut you off.
No. What I did in Chicago was with a little group that I had formed. And then, of course, when it came time to go in and do the Dark Horse record, Second Resurrection, then the family, everyone was together on board, and then we all just re-recorded it and did everything from scratch as a unit.
Where was it recorded?
We recorded at a studio in Burbank, California called Kendon Studios. Kendon was the studio that Stevie did a lot of his work. The Isley Brothers really worked there a lot. And we used the same state-of-the-art synthesizer,
which was the Tonto,
right, the multi-timbral synthesizer that only Stevie and the Isleys used, and we were the only other artist that used that Tonto synthesizer outside of Stevie and the Isleys. So that was really, creatively, that was the peak for us, I believe.
Yeah, like definitely the album was probably your most progressive in terms of the sound and what you produced. And they released two singles off of it, and you got some play from Us to You, didn't it?
From Us to You, yeah, it did get some play. It made number 9 on the charts.
Okay, and did it go pop or R&B or both?
R&B. Some pop, but mainly R&B.
So after that, what happened? Like, did the Stair Steps break up, or what was the story?
Well, you know, it was any time you have, I think, that much time that has lapsed in between. You know, we as a group, the one thing that we weren't that big on the whole fame thing. You know, we were always in music for the love of the music. And you can imagine if you've done something for several years, and for whatever the reasons, politics or whatever, things just don't really quite click. That can kind of be frustrating and even sometimes discouraging. So with the lack of real R&B record experience with Dark Horse, it was a great idea as far as being with George, one of our heroes that was a Beatle. But when it came to what Dark Horse was able to do in the way of knowing how to promote an R&B act, that wasn't probably the best match for us as a group. And, you know, understanding this too, when you have a Beatle like a George Harrison, there's not much promotion that's needed. Just the name alone works. So them taking on this new label and trying to promote acts and us being probably their only R&B act, I don't think that they quite knew how to work that record. So when it didn't take off, it just kind of left, I think, a real taste of disappointment for the family, and everyone decided to disband, and that's how I ended up somehow slipping into solo artistry.
But 4 years later, you did reform as the Invisible Man's Band, is that right?
Well, that's not quite accurate. The Invisible Man's Band really wasn't ever a true formation of the Stair Steps under a different name. The Invisible Man's Band was really exclusively my brother Clarence's concept, but we worked and contributed songs to the album as a family. But it never was really the Stair Steps working under a different name. That was Clarence Jr.'s project.
Are you saying it was more like a studio project?
Well, no. It was my brother Clarence's concept altogether. The Invisible Man's Band, the Invisible Man was Clarence Burke Jr.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Okay.
He is the Invisible Man.
Okay.
Now, because we all worked together and contributed songs, and, you know, I played bass, my brother Dennis played guitar, that's where you see all of the names of the members of the group on that project, but it was really his deal.
Okay.
It was, that wasn't like, okay, we are really the Stair Steps, but we're just working under a different name. No, that was Clarence's deal. That was his thing, and we just supported and contributed to it.
So you're saying in between sort of 76 and 80, you started focusing on your solo career then? Can you talk about that?
Well, the solo career was before the Invisible Man's band. I took a different direction altogether where, once again, I really loved playing in the early parts of our career at Stair Steps. My bass was really my first love. And I remember in my younger days even asking our father if I could just play the bass. Dad, let me play on stage. And I didn't even really care if I did choreography or was on the front line. That's how much I really loved playing. So it was a very natural thing for me once I had the opportunity and didn't have the pressure or the commitment to have to be a group member, Stair Step, what have you. I played record sessions, recording sessions for many, many years in Los Angeles from, I'd say, 1974 till 1980 until I started doing my own solo projects down the road. And that was what I was happy to do, just doing sessions.
What are some of the most important sessions you played on?
Well, I did play on Bill Withers' records. The album Menagerie with Lovely Day on it, and I've co-produced the Looking for Mr. Goodbar soundtrack with him. That was a Woody Allen, Diane Keaton starred in that. It was a big movie back then in the 70s. Curtis Mayfield, I played with him. I mean, Dusty Springfield, Maurice White of Earth, Wind and Fire, the Emotions, Diana Ross, Smokey. I mean, I did so many sessions. I mean, Greg Allman of the Allman Brothers Band, you know, with Cher and all of that stuff. I did probably anybody and everybody that was probably out in the 70s, one way or another, I worked with them.
Okay, and then you said you finally cut a solo album. What's the story with that?
Well, you know, I did one solo record right after my brothers and I stopped with the Dark Horse thing, and I did one solo record with George at Dark Horse, left from there, and then went on to RCA Records, and that's where I did two albums with RCA, had more overseas success, but the second album took off pretty well with a song called Keep Rising to the Top.
Which is all-time classic, like Stepper's record and Rap Sample, and
yes.
Everyone knows the song.
That's right, and then that's where, you know, the Kenny Burke solo thing for me really came to really be more of a, okay, this is something that now I can sink my teeth into. That I've done on my own, and Rising to the Top at the time, you know, when it was recorded, who would have known that it would become such a popular sample, where it is the single most sampled record in the history of hip hop, from, you know, Mary J. Blige to LL Cool J and Dougie Fresh and all of the people that's done it over the years. It's just been a blessing for me to have to be associated with a record like that, and one that we touched on, but I don't know if we made absolutely clear with, you know, for the Stair Steps and myself, with whatever we felt that we wanted more of out of the industry or our careers, one thing that we can say that holds very true for us is the songs that we are most known for, like The U-Child and Keep Rising to the Top, are songs that we are so proud of being a part of because of the positive lyric and the positive message that has become an inspiration for people throughout the decades. So, you know, it all kind of works out in the end if you just let God kind of leave a door open for Him to make things happen for you. So, really, we're very happy with the hand we've been dealt. Very much so.
Yeah, I mean, you've produced so much great material through all of you have produced so much great material throughout your career. Are you still performing as a solo artist?
Well, you know, we are right now contemplating. Well, you know, I've done some things on my own as a solo. I perform more overseas, and of course, you know, I still produced, you know, other artists even after the Rising to the Top. Stuff with RCA. I've done the OJs, the Whispers, Keith Sweat. I've produced Silk and, you know, some more contemporary artists that were in the, early to late 90s. And right now, I'm looking very much forward to performing live and doing more of that just for the sake of doing some great music. And there is some talk and buzz going around that there may be some reunion with maybe one or two of the family.
Wow. People are going to be really excited to hear that.
Well, you know, we're right now at a point in time in life where we are really only interested in doing the things that we want to do and that we enjoy doing. And that, of course, is a no-brainer when it comes to working and performing and singing. That's still very, very big in our lives. We, you know, that's something that we never stop loving. So, you know, it's like, okay, now let's go on and recharge the battery and go out and do it again, you know? So I think that may see something like that happen. It may really become a reality. And on that note, I wanted to give you and your listening audience a little surprise and say something to maybe a couple of members of the family. How would you like that, Bob?
That would be awesome.
Well, listen, everybody, I want to let you say hi to my sister, who you know and remember as Aloha. But now she goes by the name Rami. Say hi, everybody.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
Hey, good to talk to you.
It's great to hear from you, too, and thanks so much for making the great record that you did, too.
Oh, thank you, and I'm glad that everybody still remembers us, and I really appreciate everybody's support and following.
All right, yeah, definitely. You're probably one of the greatest groups to come out of Chicago.
Thank you so much for the compliment.
Thank you.
Yes, here's Ken.
Okay, I'm walking through the Burke household. I'm going to let you say hi to who you all never knew or probably just spoke to because he couldn't even talk at that time. But say hello to QB.
Hello?
Hello. Hi, is this QB?
Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
How's it going? I heard you're a dancer now. Is that right?
Yes, I've been a professional dancer for almost 30 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. Yeah, so where do you perform now? Do you perform all over the world pretty much?
Yes, I've been all over the world a few times. I was with Avenelli's and Dance to the Harlem in New York.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm definitely interested in coming out to see one of your performances sometime.
Well, thank you so much. What's your name?
My name is Bob.
All right, Bob. I'm going to give the phone back to Kenny. I'm eating some spaghetti I just made. So, hello, Chicago. I love Chicago, and I will come back home one day. Bye-bye.
Bye. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Now, I got somebody else here that you got to say hi to because he's the one who's responsible for it all. Chicago, you got to say hi to my dad. Here comes Papa Stairstep. Bob, say hi to Papa.
Hello, Papa Stairstep.
Howdy, Bob. How are you?
I'm doing okay. Thanks so much for putting your group together.
Well, thank you so much. I couldn't have done it without Mama Stairstep. And, of course, she's here. And I'm honored to be able to have an opportunity to speak to you. And, of course, we're all privileged when connections can be made from the past to the present, from young people like yourself, to speak to my son, Kenny. It's just grand, and I want to tell you that I don't take anything for granted. I feel privileged.
Thanks so much, and I'm honored to talk to you and all of your family.
Well, thank you so much. I'm going to give you back to Kenny, and may God always keep you and your family safe.
Thank you. You too.
How was that, Bob?
That was awesome.
and just really as spontaneous as it happened, because it just so happened that I was over here visiting with my dad and mom, and my sister and brother just happened to be by here. So, listen, I want to say to you and all of your listening audience, especially Chicagoans, how much the Berg family really appreciates all of the love that we've received throughout the years. And we want you to know that we wouldn't have never been without you. We appreciate you and love you, and thank you so much for all the support you've given us throughout the years.
Yeah, and thank you so much for making all the great music that you've made, and thank you so much for taking the time out of your day to tell this excellent story of your group.
Thank you, Bob, and it's been a pleasure. You're a gentleman and a scholar. Anytime, you let me know if there's anything you ever need. I'll be happy to do it again and again with you.
Okay, great. Well, I'll let everybody know about your reunion and anything else that you guys are doing. And thanks so much, and have a great night.
You do the same. Good night, and good night, Chicago.
Okay, and on that note, for the rest of the show, we'll be playing the Five Stair Steps. This is You Waited Too Long.